Great pleasure, Mark, once again to have a chance to speak with you about your wonderful weekly newsletter you put out on financial sector themes called Net Interest. Mark Rubinstein, of course, has been in the financial sector for many years as an analyst and portfolio manager, and always a pleasure to talk trends and themes in the financial sector. Mark, this week you wrote about cryptocurrencies, but specifically the Facebook supported, conceived, and promoted kind. So let's dive right into it. Tell us about that a little more.
Well, I guess any listener would have had to have been living on a different planet last week not to have read that Bitcoin went through $50,000 per Bitcoin. It was clearly very big news. I wrote a piece about it, less from the perspective of Bitcoin as a currency and more at the underlying technology around payments. When Bitcoin was launched in 2009, initially, and it kind of went through a metamorphosis because initially the objective was that it would represent electronic cash. In fact, in the original white paper, the term electronic cash comes up several times. Even today, people remember the famous story of the man in Florida who bought two Papa John's pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin. Clearly, those 10,000 Bitcoin are worth a lot more today than two Papa John pizzas, even very large ones. And along the way, the volatility of Bitcoin has been very, very high. And as a result, its ability to serve as a vehicle for payments is somewhat diminished. When we undertake a payment transaction, we have a certain level of tolerance for volatility. We don't want our purchasing power to be lurching up and down from day to day. And hence, central banks globally regard the stability of their currencies as one of their core objectives. Bitcoin doesn't serve that purpose. And the objective or the narrative around Bitcoin kind of pivoted a bit, maybe in 2014, 2015, maybe even a bit later, away from it acting as this payment mechanism. And in fact, actually, that's represented in the strategy of Coinbase, which is coming to the market via a direct listing over the course of the next few months. There was a news story last week that it was valued in the secondary market transaction, but at $100 billion. Phenomenal valuation for a crypto exchange that didn't start off as a crypto exchange. It started off, its strategy was to act as a kind of, as a merchant acquirer, akin to in the traditional payment space. We have merchant acquirers that plug in merchants and help them facilitate payments, in this case, of via cryptocurrency. That didn't work. And the objective pivoted away, or the narrative, I should say, the narrative shifted away from Bitcoin as a payments mechanism towards Bitcoin as a, could call it a store of value, but digital gold. Digital gold is the kind of proxy for the new narrative that emerged in 2015, 2016. That left behind a vacuum, and that vacuum was that all of the technology that was explored in that original white paper was still valid. And all of that technology lent itself very well to a new payments infrastructure. And in 2019, Facebook entered that vacuum by launching or by announcing the launch of what they called at the time Libra. Since changed its name to DM, we can go on and talk about it. But in 2019, Libra was introduced to the world as a innovation which put down a new set of rails across the world in order to facilitate specifically cross-border payments, but ultimately any sort of payments.
And so that's interesting, because the Facebook kind was really focused on payments. tell us about some parallels that you can draw to the history of Visa. And we did talk about DeHawk and Visa there, and how the ideas overlap.
Exactly. So it's interesting. And actually, DeHawk, who we spoke about last time, is still alive. He lives in the state of Washington. He is actually a advisor to not Facebook, but an alternative crypto-oriented company. And a lot of his philosophy, certainly when he launched Visa back in the late 1950s, is now being reflected in the crypto world, and specifically within Facebook's Libra, which is now called DM. So, for example, he wrote this in the 1990s, so we're not clear whether he was thinking this in the 50s and 60s. Certainly, he was thinking it by the 1990s. He talked about, and we spoke about this last time, he talked about the idea that modern technology would allow any entity, an individual or a corporation, not just a bank, to move and manipulate data. And he went on to say that as a result, anyone could become a bank, that inherent in all of this technology might be the genesis of a new form of global currency, and that nation state monopolies would no longer exist around the issuance and the control of currency. So that was one of his philosophies, and it's something that's very much reflected in the founding principles of Facebook's Libra, which is now called DM. He also went on to say, and we definitely did speak about this last time, because we spoke about JCPenney, a battle that took place internally at the level of the board of Visa around whether non-banks should be allowed access to the network. And it concerned JCPenney. JCPenney was allowed access to the network, but then the portcullis went down and no other merchant was allowed access. But he wrote, again in the late 1990s, that merchants and others, even cardholders, should have been allowed access to the network. That's not possible in the existing network of financial intermediaries like Visa, but it's something that when it launched, Facebook's Libra, or DM as it's now known, took to heart. They wanted to create a permissionless network. They recognized that there would have to be a transition to permissionless. And they anticipated that after a period of maybe 5 years, they could transition to permissionless, which would allow any entity to plug in as a node into their network. We'll talk about the regulator's reaction and the policymaker's reaction in a second. This was something they pushed back very, very heavily on. And so it's not a feature today. But there is a third element that I wanted to bring up as well. So we've talked about the philosophy that anyone should be able to plug into the network. We've talked about the idea that banks and nation states might lose their monopoly on the issuance of money. And the final thing he talked about was that there should be competing card systems, that he didn't want Visa actually to be a duopoly. He wanted there to be competition at the level of the system rather than at the level of the issuer, which is the situation we're in today. And certainly, I mean, Facebook clearly would covet a kind of a monopoly position in payments, and payments does lend itself to network economics and consequently monopoly type structures. But taking it at face value, Libra would say today, actually, that's not something they're after right now. And it's just another additional network in order that would compete against cash, against regional and domestic networks, local networks, and against the likes of Visa and MasterCard. And we'll come on to talk about this as well, central bank digital currencies, which would be a public sector alternative to what Facebook is trying to do.
So the regulators have had a robust response and reaction to this, even coordinated, which is not often you see that kind of response. Why do you think there has been that kind of response, and how has Libra or DM evolved? And you've alluded to it. as a result of that, and what are the chances of this actually getting endorsement at some point?
Well, you make a very good point that we had a concerted response from policymakers through the G7 and through other organizations like BIS in Switzerland. It made them nervous. They at its initial, so initially, the idea was that along these rails would move a new kind of currency, not a cryptocurrency, but a currency that that was like an ETF of underlying fiat currencies. So a basket linked to the US dollar, linked to the euro, linked to pound sterling, linked to the yen, and so on. The concern for smaller economies outside of those currency blocks was that if that currency was to become a dominant form of payment in their domestic economy, then they would lose control of their monetary system and their monetary sovereignty ultimately, and that they would also be impotent in their role as lender of last resort. So from a lot of smaller economies, there was a lot of backlash. And then also the larger ones as well were nervous about how this ETF, how this Libra, as it was known, would morph going forward. So a lot of concern also around know your customer and the governance of this entity, and the fact that Facebook itself was the flag bearer of this new network. If we roll forward to today, DM has taken on board many of those issues. It's changed its name from Libra to DM. A lot of the initial members of the association were scared away, really, by the initial regulatory response. So PayPal, Visa, MasterCard. And today we've got a membership which isn't that impressive, isn't as impressive, frankly. Some venture capital firms in there, but and some crypto specialists in there, but no, and some retailers as well in there, but no incumbent financial services providers. And that in and of itself may make regulators a little bit nervous. Where we are now is that the entity is awaiting authorization in Switzerland. They've chosen Switzerland, it's based in Geneva, and they've chosen Switzerland and the Swiss financial regulator as their regulatory body. There's a new head of that entity who is on the record as saying that they are looking at this very carefully, and they will likely apply bank-like capital requirements and prudential requirements of DM. So the regulatory oversight is going to be pretty intense. But right now, the membership isn't as impressive. They've made some changes. They're going to issue single coins, so a DM dollar backed by a real dollar, a DM euro backed by a real euro, rather than this ETF initially. And they've abandoned this idea about going permissionless, which is something that the regulators were really nervous about, that anyone could just plug into this network. They've abandoned that. So a number of changes. Notwithstanding all of that, regulators are still nervous. And Facebook has been in the news quite recently around in Australia, the issue of paying for links to news entities. And it's causing a bit more of a stir, and regulators are nervous anyway about Facebook's power. So as a result of that, Facebook itself is no longer the face of this entity. In fact, if you go onto the DM website, it's difficult to find. You certainly won't find the logo of Facebook. It's difficult even to find the name of Facebook. But all the policymakers know that Facebook's behind it, and therefore that may not be to the short-term advantage of this thing coming to the market anytime soon.
And it's perhaps unclear to the regulators or just in general to the market what it really means to say Facebook is behind it, because I think technically this is completely independent of Facebook. And yet we have rhetoric from some regulators like a wolf in sheep's clothing is still a wolf, and so forth. So my question to you would be, if this is truly independent of Facebook, why has Facebook been so keen on pushing this instead of perhaps just getting on board with an existing initiative or endorsing a cryptocurrency that's pursuing similar objectives?
It's a really good question. And I think in order to answer it, we have to analyze the economics of payments. If you look at the structure today, and you, John, linked last week a very good presentation by the payments analyst, the Visa stock analyst at JP Morgan in the weekly. And he explains actually very clearly the economics of payments, which are as follows, that in a typical $100 card transaction, the issuer, i.e. the entity that has the attention of the consumer, that has the interface with the consumer, takes, so there's a $100 transaction, the payment system will take $3 of that, and the merchant ultimately will take $97. Of that $3, that entity that interfaces with the consumer, with the customer, takes $2. So two-thirds of the network of the payments economics goes to the issuer. Visa actually only gets 15 cents. So now, clearly, it's a very high margin business. It's a very high margin business, and scale. And there are scale. There are clear scale benefits there as well. Those 15 cents add up. But the attractive, from Facebook's perspective, the attractive part of this is the two-thirds of the pie, which is the $2, which requires, and also that's where their competitive advantage is, i.e., the closeness with the consumer. So if they can create a wallet, which they have done. So they've set up a company called Novi, which is their wallet. If they can get that wallet in the hands of their 2 billion plus customers around the world, then that's very effective, and they can then attack that $2 because the cost of payment through this new network might be lower. It's kind of debatable whether it'll be lower, because a lot of that $3 is less in the technology and more in the know your customer, more in the anti-fraud, more in the compliance aspect of it than the technology. But put that to one side, if they can attack that $2 through their wallet, then that's where the economics are. So, and again, there's a parallel here with Visa and Bank of America. Bank of America initially owned the Visa network, but they agreed to pool their share in it to all of the other banks, all of the other wallet providers, in order that they can focus on that front end bit, that $2 bit, and create a much more robust network underneath that. So the value chain was spliced up, and they moved to the front end of it. And I think that's basically what Facebook today has its eyes on.
The compromises that DM has had to make to remain viable, like not truly being permissionless, what do you think that actually does to the attractiveness of it? Because isn't that feature of being permissionless a key benefit that blockchain type payment mechanisms ought to have?
It's a very interesting point, and certainly the diehard crypto enthusiasts would regard permissionless as being non-negotiable. The issue is that we have a trade-off here, a very simple trade-off between efficiency or scale on the one axis and trust on the other axis. And so those diehard crypto enthusiasts would argue that trust is more important, and they might be prepared to sacrifice some efficiency benefits. So Bitcoin right now, my understanding, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, is that it can do 7 transactions per second. Visa can do tens of thousands of transactions per second. And so the trade-off here is to do is somewhere in between. Obviously, and the flip side is kind of blockchain broadly is the trust is in the technology rather than in a centralized entity. Whereas through the Visa network, trust has to be in the, it's a very centralized way of doing payments. It's a very centralized network and the trust has to be in the entity. So that's the trade-off. And the idea here is we go somewhere in between. So kind of goes against their underlying kind of philosophy around permissionless, but for the benefit of that trade-off, they're prepared to make that sacrifice.
The point on number of transactions per second is very interesting because I believe Diem would increase that significantly from where Bitcoin is or would be, I guess, if it was a payment mechanism. I believe it would be about 1,000 per second. Is that right for Diem?
Exactly. That's what's being suggested currently. Exactly. That's right.
And I guess the big question then is, and this is, I guess I'm asking for your conclusion or opinion, if you will, based on the research you've done, to weigh the benefits of a new type of payment mechanism like the one like Diem, for example, versus what's available today, where you do have to rely on Visa as the trust verifier. How do you weigh the benefits and drawbacks? And do you think we end up with two parallel systems that are available to everyone, or do we ultimately settle or gravitate toward one or the other?
I think ultimately, it's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I think in the medium term, we will see more networks emerge. So already we've begun to see this actually. Already in countries like India, there are some government-sponsored networks which are very, very fast and very scalable. In other countries, we're seeing central banks, including in the US, we're seeing with faster internal domestic payments infrastructure emerging. Clearly we've got Visa and MasterCard, and then going forward I think we'll see some central bank digital currencies. So big news in China at the moment is the piloting they're doing of a central bank digital currency. In the Bahamas we already have one live. The sand dollar in the Bahamas is a fiat Bahamas dollar currency that is now available in wallets in that particular country. And in Sweden, they are piloting e-krona as well. So many countries will be piloting and potentially launching their own domestic fiat-backed digital currencies. And those will also represent threats and additional competition in the electronic payment space. So electronic payments, I think, is going to get more competitive. Ultimately, there is a view, and clearly we saw this around Visa and MasterCard, that network economics prevail, and we may begin to see ultimately share then coalesce around some winners. But right now it's very, very open.
Well, Mark, it's certainly a fascinating area of payments. We will keep watching it closely. Thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you, John. Thank you.